think this has been an amazing day for sports fans, basketball fans in particular. It's been a great day with them setting such a unbelievable record. I mean, you think about that, man, 73 wins. I mean, that's ridiculous. And then obviously what happened here tonight. I mean, it's been a great night in basketball history, I think.
Well, I don't think Kobe really could have said it any better, frankly. This is one of my probably greatest nights ever as a sports fan. Maybe greatest one as an NBA journalist. Certainly probably maybe the greatest feat that I'll ever see in person, being at Oracle for the 73 wins. But I think we really, Kobe managed to overshadow that.
He did. And the way that I kind of conceived of it, watching the whole game after we each got back from Oracle, was I thought this was a really representative game of Kobe's, not in terms of his career, but in terms of if you wanted to explain to somebody who didn't maybe know him or know basketball in that way, what his appeal was. I think you could show them this game, give them a little bit of context, and they'd get it.
I thought this is I have a lot more thoughts on that and kind of how this was just was peak Kobe, maybe in every sense of the word. But I thought, just thinking about it, might be the most improbable performance by anyone ever in NBA history. Like, no, there's no one who thought that this could have been possible. I mean, even though he did take, like, the 50 shots, you know, I didn't think, I thought the game would be a farce, like, because we were at Oracle, we didn't see it. I went back and watched it, I was like, no, this actually was, like, this was legit, and then they came back and won. Like, Utah, I mean, they didn't do a very good job at the end, but they were trying, you know, so, like, it was just a remarkable game, a remarkable performance, and I never thought, and we'll get obviously into the nitty-gritty of how he managed to do this, but I never thought that he just had this in him, in his legs. I mean, he was playing completely differently than he really had played at any time since the Achilles injury.
Yeah, I got to see one of his better games of this season when I was in Washington at the Verizon Center. He had a nice game, and they won that one as well, and you saw little glimmers of it, but it was so much more consistent in this game. Basically, like, it felt like he'd been saving himself.
Yeah, I mean, like, even in that game, as I recall, he was just, like, jacking up shots, and they just happened to go
right
in.
And he had a couple nice drives.
It had more of that feel.
Yeah, he had a couple nice drives, but it was more just the same shots were going in for the most part.
Yeah, I mean, to me, I'm trying to think of a more improbable performance ever in, you know, real professional sports history. I actually thought of another LA moment, the Kirk Gibson home run in game one of the World Series when he was injured and came in and in his only at bat of the series. I forget what his injury was, but he could barely walk and hit that home run in against the A's in 1988. Like, that's really the one that really comes back. I mean, Willis Reed, he scored 4 points in that game. You know, he didn't score 60 points. I mean, granted, there wasn't like an acute injury involved for Kobe here, but just this was so far above the level of what he had done all year that I was just like so shocked that it happened. And then to watch it, I was more shocked that, you know, he really was legitimately playing well. You know, it wasn't just a case of like him just getting lucky on a bunch of bombs. And like, because when he actually did try to, he was able to manufacture good shots. He was 16 out of 29 from two in this game. And you know, if he hadn't been jacking up so many threes, like, he could have actually even been more efficient than he was.
One of the things that I loved about watching this game, despite knowing the result, knowing everything, you know, knowing how things turned out, and both an individual and a team perspective, was how it built. The Lakers struggled early, then they, you know, they were playing better, but they were still behind. Kobe started getting off, and the crowd was doing really well. And then you're still sitting there with about, you know, 3.5 minutes to go, and of course we'll go through this in more detail, and you're sitting there going, okay, well, how do we get from here to where this ended? And it was just a perfect story. It built into this amazing climax, and yeah, there's some weird context with it. Team is going to have the, you know, second most ping pong balls, but as a piece of storytelling and as a piece of art, it was actually, I was very affected by it. I thought it was an amazing story.
Yeah, I thought so too. And it was just so impressive. The fact too that he missed his first five shots as well. You know, you thought like, oh, this is just going to be a train wreck. You know, you're seeing it. Twitter was actually down for the beginning of it, for us at least. But, you know, you're looking at the box and like, oh, he's 0-for-5. Like, this is going to be a disaster. And then he hits his next five, and all of a sudden he's rolling. And you know, we were fairly incredulous. Kobe was just as incredulous about it himself.
You know, honestly, I can't believe this actually happened, to be honest with you. Like, it's kind of crazy to me. Like, I still don't, it's hard to believe that it happened this way. It really is. Like, I'm still in shock about it. And just, you know, the outpouring of support all night long, and my, you know, former teammates and the fans and my family. And it was just, you know, it's unbelievable, man. Unbelievable. Like, I'm still in shock about it. And I think now I'll allow myself to go back and read a lot of the things and watch some of the commentary and the videos and just kind of take it all in, you know?
Yeah, so the context of this, and the other thing that occurred to me is this never happens if they're any good, right? Like, you know, they don't just feed, I mean, and obviously they, you know, they won the game and you know, he played well, but they were obviously just trying to feed it to him every single time. Like, that was, there's definitely like that aspect to it, you know, and I sort of appreciated that single-mindedness of purpose to sort of like almost like they're playing a video game to just make it about him. Like, this ridiculous performance, like, almost made all of the pain of this year worth it. Maybe not the pain of the last 3 years, but maybe at least this year.
Yeah, that and the fact that they're probably going to keep their pick. I mean, you can think about the way that this season, the way that the perception has shifted from today versus, let's say, like 2 weeks ago, especially if they keep their pick. You know, it's the nice closeout. It could open things up. And yeah, and as a, you know, as a piece of fan service, it couldn't have gone any better.
That's interesting. I would love to ask a Lakers fan, like, would you have rather had this storybook ending to remember Kobe by forever, or would you have rather had them, you know, be the sixth seed the last 2 years and lose, and him, you know, play okay, but like play a lot more conservatively and just kind of, you know, fit into the background and be making less money, you know, whatever. I don't know. I'm going to think about this night for a long, long time, more than I would have if he just had kind of petered out the way I think a lot of people expected him to. It was pretty remarkable. The last thing that was kind of the lasting image of this game too, and I thought, just, you know, the contrast between what he did and what Golden State did was so apparent. You know, it was Golden State is three-pointers, most passes in the league, you know, move the ball. Egalitarian, even though you have this superstar, he's like maybe the most selfless superstar that we've had. You know, he's very unassuming, pretty much the exact opposite image that Kobe has. And then you had Kobe, you know, going to his right for the two-pointer that gave LA the lead, basically his heels on the three-point line. So he's taking like the worst possible long two, jump shot, hand in his face, pulling up, and, you know, he drains it. And it was not a great shot, except when it goes in, it's completely impossible to stop. You know, and it was the contrast between those two things, the Warriors setting the all-time wins record, the Lakers winning, what, their 16th game of the season. Just the contrast between the old and the new today, it really is. There's all this, you could provide all of these sort of storytelling axioms that we probably are not close enough to any English majors to actually really know what they should be, but every aspect of tonight was just so enjoyable and interesting to me from just a storytelling perspective, kind of a fan perspective almost. So let's take a quick break here. This is the one-year anniversary of our podcast, and I want to ask a huge favor of our listeners. You're kind enough to listen to us, as we hope, for a few hours a week, but we want to ask for 3 minutes of your time to fill out a survey that can help us get advertisers and can also win you. One of the people who responds is going to get a $100 Amazon gift card. The URL is podsurvey.com/capspace. That's podsurvey.com/capspace. Usually on these, between 2% and 8% of listeners respond to these surveys, and on a night where some records were set, I hope you will help us set a record ourselves to have a higher percentage of our listeners respond than most other podcasts do. The more people respond to the survey, the better we look to advertisers. Plus, you can get that $100 gift card. And, you know, we promise that when we get more sponsors, we're not going to give you too many ads. We'll just do two in the body of the show and maybe one pre-roll. So 3 minutes of ads per hour a show. I hope that's not too bad, considering that radio and TV are like one-third commercials. So that URL again, podsurvey.com/capspace. You remember Capspace, that's the code for all the sponsors. You go to my Twitter page, Nate Duncan NBA, that it's pinned to the top, a link to it, so you don't even have to enter that in. You can just go to my Twitter page and click on it, podsurvey.com/capspace. Thanks so much for all your support over this past year, and hopefully we'll make it worth it to you starting right now. Let's get some crazy stats in this game, Danny.
There were so many of them. Do you want to start with just the Kobe-specific stuff?
Well, that's...
that's all. I mean, it's all Kobe.
Did other players play in this game?
Technically, yes. But so he had 42 minutes, 96 touches, which produced 50 shots, 33 passes, which produced 4 assists and 2 secondary hockey assists.
Yeah, and he was 8 of 40 on contested field goals. That's with a defender within 4, or I'm sorry, not 8 of 4, 18 of 40 on contested field goals, 4 of 10 on uncontested. So 80% of his shots were contested. He took 40 contested shots, but he actually got to the rim for 12 shots, and then he took 8 more in the lane. So that's a lot more than he had been taking. And then for mid-range, he was a further 5 out of 9. So that made up his 16 out of 29 from 2, and then 6 out of 21 on threes. But really, you know, he didn't take his twos. Like, none of them were really that bad. Like, he probably took, like, 6 or 7 just completely ridiculous threes. But, you know, it's not really a much higher percentage than, you know, his normal shots that he would take over the course of his career anyway.
Yeah, and those did lead to some kind of some craziness just because of the idea of his total numbers getting to where they did. So he ended up tying Damon Stoudemire for the second most attempted three-pointers in a game in NBA history with 21, which is one behind the immortal J.R. Smith with 22. And for reference, before tonight, incidentally, Steph Curry's career high was 18.
Yeah, and he had 19 tonight. Correct. And but yeah, so how many players have taken 50 shots in a game?
That's actually a hard question to answer, but it seems like it's just Kobe and Wilt.
Yeah, at least in the modern era, which Basketball Reference only has it in the database back to 83-84, he is first in that span. I think MJ had 64 points and 49 shots in a game against the Magic in 1993, and I think that went into either like double overtime or so. It might have even gone into triple overtime that game. So this is by far the most shots. I mean, despite the fact that they claimed he was going to shoot every time, like, there's no way we could have anticipated this, that he would set it career high. Kobe himself was 17 out of 47, but only had 41 points in just a normal game in his prime against Boston in November of 2002. That Laker fans will remember that that's when the year that Shaq got toe surgery in the off season and then said he was going to rehab on company time. Or he didn't get it done like early enough in the offseason, so he was still rehabbing. He missed like the first month of the year, and Kobe was like the only guy on the team at that point. But yeah, I mean, he was more efficient than some of the games. You know, that's another thing that makes me say, like, you know, this wasn't like as ridiculous as it might seem, because he actually played this way in his prime, like on good teams on occasion. Even.
Yeah, that's why to me it was representative in that kind of a way. It was, you know, it was definitely an extreme, but it was an extreme in the way that he was kind of beloved and for the people who were critics in that way, and that's part of the reason why I have so much affection for this game.
One of the stats I thought was really interesting that you compiled were basically like what the distribution of shots were and what the efficiency was when everyone else, when he was in, basically, for all of the other players, the non-Kobe players.
Yeah, so in the first quarter, he played the entire thing, and so he took 13 shots, and everybody else took 9. I think, I don't have the number on it, I think it was, they made 6, it was 6 or 7, I think. And then in the rest of the game that he played, because he sat those couple minutes, I think it was a little bit less than 6, in the second quarter, he took 37 shots, everyone else took 19, and they made 13 of those 19.
Yeah, that's a pretty ridiculous shooting for everyone else. And you know, it was almost like, you know, a pitcher who always throws in the outside corner, which would be like him shooting. And then when he comes inside, he actually passes. It's really effective. But, you know, the times when he just straight up got double teamed, like most of the time he passed it. You know, I mean, there are a couple of times where, you know, if the ball was in his hands and he was covered one-on-one, he was going to shoot it. But when they actually, like, double-teamed or they, like, brought someone over on the strong side zone when he tried to ISO, like, he made some pretty effective passes to kind of get things started for his teammates at times. They even used him as a decoy a couple of times, too. So again, I mean, it was a really pretty incredible performance. You know, and that's not to say that if they'd given the ball to someone else, like, they couldn't have been just as efficient. You know, this wasn't a good Jazz defense in this game, as we'll get to. But, you know, it was like kind of real basketball.
It was definitely close enough to it.
But it was just like, it was real basketball in the sense that they were just like, all right, we're going to start the offense with this guy literally every single play down.
Yeah. Two other stats that I really loved that were both on the ESPN broadcast, and also I want to mention that I loved the call that Mike Tirico and Hubie Brown gave for this game. I thought it set a really nice tone. I thought they had fun with it, but they gave the proper respect. And two of their stats crew did a great job with this game. Two things that I just didn't know was Kobe Bryant had, before this game, had scored 40 or more points against every team in the NBA. The only other person to do that is Bob Pettit. I thought that was really cool. And they actually had the stat, which I would have never been able to put together, of the record for most points in a player's final NBA game. And what makes this so much better is that the player with the record before Kobe was Jordan Crawford with 41.
That is absolutely amazing. Another really important stat to Tarik Black, our boy, 4 fouls in 18 minutes. The legend of Tarik
and
Black.
And an important block.
Lives on.
Well, important in a way.
So let's get into some specific observations. You know, the Jazz, I mean, they didn't play well in this game. Rudy Gobert didn't play. Derek Favors didn't play. They don't have any other good Jeff Withey was okay, but it was mostly, you know, he wasn't playing that much. But they weren't quite like the Washington Jazz rolls in this game. Like, they, you know, Quinn Snyder was actually trying. They had been eliminated from playoff contention. I'm sure they were down, and it was kind of hard to get up for the game. They didn't really have anyone who was, you know, a great wing defender who plays a lot for them. Chris Johnson is the only one. He actually was somehow plus 19 in 20 minutes in this game that they, you know, ended up losing by 5. So yeah, I thought it just kind of in general to what we haven't said before, Kobe was just fantastic moving to the basket. You know, he looked explosive. You know, he looked like about, you know, other than the fact that, like, he wasn't able to actually dunk any of his finishes when he was open. But, like, one of the things that I noticed about him in these last few years, even, like, you know, it was that he didn't really seem to have any moves anymore, you know, and he actually was, like, faking guys out in this game, like, jab-stepping, like, getting them wrong-footed, blowing by them, crossovers, in-and-out dribbles, like, and so he was actually getting to where, and he had more lift than he normally does, he was actually getting to where, you know, he was open for these shots, you know, for a lot of these, and that's why I think he was able to convert, like, a pretty good percentage of them when he wasn't just trying to jack up a three, and, like, when he was shooting his threes, he kind of looked like the same guy that he'd been for the last 3 years, because he was just kind of not really making a move and just kind of hanging out there and then just shooting it and being contested.
Yeah, the combination of craft and energy was something that we haven't seen him a lot. And that was actually something that had been disappointing for me with him the last couple of years. And he brought it out in this game. He had a couple of really nice finishes as well, where there was one where he went under the basket on Jeff Withey to try to avoid the block. I think he even got an and one on that. And I was sitting there going, good. You know, I was really happy for Kobe in that way. And one thing I wanted to mention this before that I didn't is that I was very pleased. I thought the atmosphere for that game was fantastic. The crowd was incredibly enthusiastic. They were celebratory when necessary. But I thought they did a great job of elevating that game as well.
Yeah, I thought that was true, too. And I thought that ESPN did a great job telecasting it. Like, the fact that they just put his number of points and but not only his number of points, but, like, what he was shooting on field goals as well, like, to actually provide some context while still giving you the information. Like, it was just sitting there at the bottom of the screen the entire game, like, how many points he had and what he was shooting from the field. I thought that was cool. You know, Hubie was just, like, going nuts at times. He was great. Tirico was pretty good, too, like you said. I really enjoyed all of that. And the other thing, too, is, like, it was a pretty fun game just in general. Like, the Lakers had some pretty sweet plays. Other than that, like, they had this one play where Hayward just faked out Julius Randle with a really nice, like, almost and one, like, fake pick up his dribble move, and then blew past him. Randle recovered, stripped it, and then threw it ahead to Clarkson for a 360 that was really nice. That probably would have been, you know, the lead play on SportsCenter if it hadn't been for all this Kobe stuff. There's another play where Kobe passed it ahead to D'Angelo, went between the legs to Randle for a dunk. They had this great alley-oop to Larry Nance as well after a block shot. There are a lot of really exciting plays in this game that I enjoyed immensely.
Yeah, I love that we also got to have this fun Lakers game at the end of the year to really kind of be the capstone, not only for Lakers fans, but just for other people as like, okay, you know, to think about the season in a little bit more of a positive light.
So you mentioned, though, how ridiculous the comeback was. I mean, they were down 10 with 3:20 left in the game. And I want to kind of take us through the last of these possessions here. I mean, they were even down 10 with 2:35 left. You know, your win expectancy in that point is probably like 1% or something. I mean, that's and you know, the Jazz did, they only had one turnover, and it was like they weren't just throwing it away into, like, you know, pick sixes or anything like that. Like, they kind of ground the clock down, and just the Lakers stopped him every time, and then Kobe scored pretty much every time. Like, it started with Kobe backing down Hayward, and this was kind of, you know, veteran craft from Kobe. Like, Mac came over, was kind of strong side zoning it, and then when Russell went away to the weak side corner, Mac left, and Kobe saw that, and then he just blew past Hayward on a spin to the baseline. It, like, great technique. Like, he did the initial spin, and instead of trying to go as fast as he could, he kind of did it slowly. Hayward thought that he had him, and then Kobe accelerated again. Like, great change in speed, and then Lyles had no help at all. One thing that was pretty common in this game was the Lakers' bigs, knowing essentially that Kobe was going to shoot every time, and like he wasn't going to pass it to them for a dunk. Whenever Kobe would drive, they would just hold whoever was, you know, Andrew Bogut style, whoever, you know, was guarding them. That actually was really effective. You know, not that like Trey Lyles was really going to be protecting the rim anyway.
Yeah, it just created a little bit more space, and I think Kobe used every inch they gave him.
So they're within 8, and then Kobe gives up a backdoor cut after the Jazz had gotten an offensive rebound to Chris Johnson, and so they're down 10 again. Kobe is like, you know, slams the ball down in frustration. But then the Lakers scored 15 points in the last 2:36 of the game, and were 13 of those by Kobe?
They were, and then the other ones were were assisted by him. I think he had a hand in the last 19 Lakers points. I think that was the number they said on the broadcast.
Yeah. So Kobe, the next time, just kind of worked Hayward into position. Again, like, the Lakers bigs just held the Jazz bigs where they couldn't help, and Kobe ended up getting fouled. Quinn, at this point, takes out Chris Johnson, who wasn't actually guarding Kobe anyway. It was mostly Hayward and actually Joe Ingles on a couple of these possessions. He puts in Joe Ingles to go offense, defense. They're still up by 8. Hayward then blew past Larry Nance late in the clock, and he definitely got fouled by Julius Randle, I think.
Oh, yeah.
He was basically going to be wide open for a dunk, and Julius just hacked him, and Hayward kind of looked over at the ref and didn't really complain too vociferously as they were coming back down the floor. And so at that point, Kobe, you know, was in transition. They did a pick and roll in transition on the right side of the floor, and he got Trevor Booker on a switch and just kind of barreled into him, threw a floater up way high in the air. And so it was then they were within 6 with 1:38 left. And, you know, Kobe had a quote after the game that kind of reminded me a little bit of that play when he talked about, you know, what his teammates were saying to him throughout the game.
My teammates were just continuing to encourage me and continuing to say, dude, shoot. And I was just like, it's like reverse. You know, it's a weird year. You know what I mean? Like, go from being the villain to now being some type of a hero, and then go from everybody saying pass the ball to shoot the ball. It's like really strange. But I enjoyed it, man. They were very encouraging and continuing to feed me and set picks for me and stuff. And it felt like a sense of responsibility to continue to play. I mean, there are times where I drove to the basket, dude, but my legs were just like, what are you, nuts? And I just throw the ball up and it goes in. I was like, oh, thank God.
Yeah, so that floater was one of those, like, just throwing the ball up plays. But, you know, he's got great touch. It went in. And then Utah came back down. Did you think that play by Mac was a travel?
I didn't. It wasn't as egregious to me as, you know, as some other calls in other games. But I did not think he traveled.
Yeah, and they called it really early. Like, he was sort of, like, about to travel, but he hadn't yet. I mean, he picked it up, but he still had his pivot. And then someone kind of crashed into him a little bit from behind. Usually that won't get called a foul, just be called a travel because it's just kind of incidental contact. But I thought they definitely had, like, a quick whistle. I would say maybe that the whistles kind of favored the Lakers a little bit down the stretch. Not that it really matters, you know, that much, frankly.
In some ways, for Utah, it's a good thing, depending on how important you think the 12th versus the 13th pick is.
Yeah, that's true, because they would have been tied with Washington. And again, I don't think they tried to lose
no.
the game. Like, I was sort of expecting to see that. And, no, like, Quinn Snyder was calling timeouts. Like, he was actually, like, trying stuff. You know, they were trying to go to the basket. Like, they just, you know, missed layups, like, got fouled, didn't get a call. You know, they only had one turnover, like I said. Yeah, the next time down, the crowd is just chanting Kobe over and over again. Ingles was guarding Kobe. And one thing, actually, another thing that the Lakers bigs did pretty well in this game was in pick-and-roll situations with Kobe, even though they knew it was coming, and the Jazz bigs did a pretty bad job of reacting to this. Like, Randall, for example, would sprint up there as hard as he could to set the screen so that his man was kind of trailing and Kobe could get a head start going downhill. And Kobe just, Booker was late, and that left room for Kobe to split that trap and get to the free throw line. He had an easy pull-up J. He did ignore a wide-open Jordan Clarkson, who was wide open in the right corner as Hayward stepped up. But
totally justified.
You know, he was wide open.
Totally justified.
You know, yeah, wasn't that bad of a shot.
And then, the Jazz came back down, and they tried to attack using a pick-and-roll. And they didn't. I was actually surprised that they didn't get anything better off of that. I thought they were going to get something more off of it, and then they ended up settling for a three that Gordon Hayward missed.
Yeah, I thought they were going to do better. They got Julius Randle, who actually is an underrated guy, switching just one on one against smaller players. Switched on to Hayward, and what the Jazz will do, and I think a lot of more teams should start doing this, is, Quinn Snyder, we've talked about it before on the program, he loves to play with the path, basically, like, and do what I call a Dunleavy cut. Mike Dunleavy was one of the first guys I saw to do this, where you basically start your drive as you're receiving, maybe even before you're receiving the pass, and you maybe the path leads you a little bit, but you kind of just catch your defender unawares. That way, if you're moving already before you've even caught the ball. And so what they've started doing with Hayward is when he gets the switch, he'll just throw it to whoever's standing, one pass away, and then instantly have him just throw the pass back so they can't switch back, and he'll be on the move then, and Randle did a good job of guarding that, and Hayward's three was not particularly close. So it's a four-point game with 107 left at that point. And then Kobe hit what I thought was really the biggest shot. I mean, they're still big favorites, the Jazz are. But Randle set another one of those screens where he kind of raced up there on Ingles, and Kobe was going to his left. He was able to just pull up right over Trey Lyles, who's not really a very athletic defender, for a three on the left wing. It was still contested. Hubie may have just, like, completely lost it on the sidelines. They cut to his oldest daughter. They're within one. And Kobe was asked after the game about his daughter's reaction watching him go for 60 points.
The coolest thing is that my kids actually saw me play like I used to play. You know what I mean? It was like, whoa, Dad. And I said, yeah, I used to do this pretty often. They were like, really? It's like, dude, YouTube it. You know what I mean? So it was pretty cool for them to actually see that. So.
Yeah, I think that his daughters probably felt about the way we all did, frankly.
but it would be weird, I just don't really have a place of reference for this, to hear so much...
Your dad was not an NBA superstar?
Sadly, no. To hear all the stuff about just the incandescent talent, and to see your dad doing the same job, just not at the same level, and then to see kind of that performance, you go, oh, okay, I can kind of get it now.
The next time down, Quinn... I think they called a timeout at this point. Yeah, they must
I think
have
they did.
Really, like, cutting to the crowd. They ran a pick and roll for Mac and Lyles, and they threw the ball back to Mac on the left wing after they had helped out on Lyles, and Mac just missed a wide open three. It was good shot, good action, just missed it. That obviously could have iced things, basically putting him back up four. And so then they still had Gordon Hayward on Kobe. And another time where Randle did a great job of sprinting up there, Kobe used the screen, and then he reused it. Randle just held the crap out of Hayward. I mean, those Laker bigs were just, like, played their job as supporting pieces quite well. And that was that long two that I talked about, where he's going to his right just inside the line. Not the most efficient shot, but I guess when you only need a two or a three, either one gives you the lead. It doesn't really matter where you're shooting from, and you know, he hit it.
Yeah, as much as the three was the more amazing shot, I think that was the more identifiable kind of definitive shot of this game.
Yeah, because it gave them the lead. I mean, you still didn't think that it would necessarily be possible. But Quinn was still trying. You know, the Lakers were switching something. He set up a play that was pretty nice to have Hayward run off a screen away from the corner where they had inbounded the ball and then immediately run back and try to curl to the basket. Larry Nance did a great job of switching onto him. Nance had a pretty good defensive game. Lyles drove into a contest by Julius Randle, and Lyles, somewhat of a surprising miss. Like, you thought as that was happening, I mean, we knew he missed it, but I was like, oh, wow, that's the shot he missed. Like, it looked like it was a pretty good shot. And then Randle instantly shoves it to Kobe. You know, he was so happy that Kobe's the guy right next to him. But they gave their foul to give on Kobe. So then they inbounded the ball, and Kobe basically just, like, shoves Hayward, like, halfway down the court.
It was amazing.
To get the ball. Totally blatant. Knew he wasn't going to get called for it. And so then he had the two free throws for it to ice the game and to get to 60 points. And he made both of them. The fans, actually, I was surprised. They were actually, like, really quiet during that. You know, a few fans were, like, chanting MVP, but everyone was kind of like, all right, let's be quiet and, like, not distract him. And he made both of the free throws.
Well, he'd had some struggles at the line early in the game. I remember one where he called it short before it even, like, even was short. And so, you know, you kind of have those moments. But I thought it was a pretty amazing spot that they kind of chose what to do and then of course went crazy once he hit the second shot.
Yeah, and then there was a quick two attempt by Gordon Hayward. He again missed the layup. There might have been some contact there as well, and Kobe ended up with the ball, and Jordan Clarkson just sprinted down as soon as the shot went up, basically, which, you know, probably wasn't the greatest idea in case Utah had gotten an offensive rebound and, like, tried to kick it out for a three. He might have wanted to stick around there. But they did get the rebound, and then Kobe, in his final act, threw it down to Clarkson for the monster dunk, and then they subbed him out up by five, and he got a huge ovation, and that was it.
And then Clarkson threw the ball away.
Yeah, at the end of the game, he just, like, threw the ball into the stands. Like, that was just, like, a total rookie move. I wonder who has that ball right now.
Well, yeah, because it's been the last couple of days with the Warriors, they've been talking about how, like, Curry talked about how he made that mistake during the finals, that he just threw the ball, and so he kept the ball after, I think it was the Spurs game. And then Draymond got it after the 73 and never let it go.
All right, any kind of closing thoughts here on Kobe Bryant? I guess I can say Seth and I did a podcast back in early December that I'll tweet out the link to, maybe even put it in the description of this show, that kind of put Kobe's career in a little more perspective once we found out that he was retiring. So it's probably isn't the time for that, just to talk about this night and what it meant. I mean, is there anything else that kind of stuck out from this game that we haven't gotten to in the previous 30 minutes or so here?
In a game that had no stakes, it was still one of the most enjoyable basketball experiences that I've had. And that was knowing the results. You know, like, it was so weird to enjoy something this much when there was so little mystery. But it was just a phenomenal experience.
Yeah, and to know that it meant nothing, and yet, you know, we both, I'm sure, on Twitter and just have been annoyed by the Kobe fans and the cult of Kobe. But, you know, in a way, that all is what circled back to make this so interesting. You know, they suffered through this long season, desperately hoping that even a glimmer of a game like this could occur for Kobe. You would hear how much the crowd would cheer every time he would shoot, and he'd go 1-for-7 and, you know, play 20 minutes and wouldn't be able to finish the game. Probably actually more like, you know, 3-for-15 or something. If he played 20 minutes, he wasn't taking only 7 shots this year. But, you know, with this, you knew, especially in just what has been essentially 3 lost seasons, sacrificed to the altar of this Laker obsession with Kobe Bryant, the amount of salary cap space that has taken up, the fact that he just continued to shoot over and over again, even when he was shooting in the mid-30s from the field. You know, this is like why all of that happened, because people were desperately hoping that there would be nights like this. This is the only night. Tonight was the only way that any of that could have just been salvaged in anyone's memories, that, you know, people have been talking about Kobe's legacy would be totally tarnished by these last 3 years. And so many people, because they believe in Kobe and love him so much, had just so much wrapped up in this one game as it began to become clear that he was actually, you know, kind of on his way to a monster game. And even if they hadn't won the game, it still wouldn't have really been like that great. You know, I mean, unless he had, because if he'd gotten to 60 and they had lost by 15, it would have been, well, you know, he took 50 shots. They, you know, it was just another Kobe self-aggrandizement, and this game didn't mean anything, and they lost it anyway. You know, so who cares that he scored this number of points? It was just a farce. But they actually won, and he was unbelievable down the stretch. Like, he actually was clutch in the way that, you know, he kind of actually, you know, the numbers show that he wasn't that clutch. He actually lived up to that today, and it just, knowing that, like, so many people's just like basketball fandom self-esteem was riding on this, and to have him actually deliver, I mean, that must just have been an amazingly cathartic feeling for so many Laker fans.
Yeah, and I connected with that because I lived in LA during the Kobe post-Shaq Kobe time when I watched the 81-point game live, and that was kind of the dark ages before the current ones when they were barely making the playoffs when they didn't make it that one year. And so that kind of gave, I had an understanding of, you know, what those fans, I went to college with some of the big, you know, pre-Twitter Kobe stands and all this kind of stuff, and the emotional connection with that team and that, then the players, and that he's really the last vestige of those truly successful Lakers teams, to really have kind of a capper on that whole experience, because now they're going to have a dramatically different team. And so they can carve their own identity, and they got a nice little capstone on Dr. Buss, on so many other things. And I think this game will reverberate for that kind of a community for probably for a lot of these people for the rest of their lives.
I couldn't have put it better. Let's get to Golden State. But I want to tell you first about our friends at Indochino Custom Menswear. Made-to-measure suits used to be way too expensive. I always wanted to buy one. I couldn't really afford it. They cost thousands of dollars. Now Indochino, however, is providing made-to-measure suits for much less. My listeners today can get any premium suit for just $3.99, up to 50% off at Indochino.com when entering that familiar cap space code, all one word. Shipping is free, and you also can get it altered if you need it. You probably won't, because you're providing 14 measurements to them, and they are making the suit specifically to fit your body. But if it doesn't fit perfectly, they can make some small alterations. And if it doesn't work out after that, you can return it completely for free. So it's risk-free if you don't get a great suit, and you can save hundreds of dollars for a suit that's just as good, probably better, than anything that you can get at a department store, because it fits you perfectly with those 14 unique measurements. So go to Indochino.com, enter that promo code CAPSPACE, any premium suit for just $3.99, free shipping with that CAPSPACE code. Indochino, your look, your way. So we just came back from Oracle. We're recording this. It is now 4:27 a.m. because it took some time to get the audio together and watch that Kobe game in full. But, I mean, this was just an unbelievable atmosphere. And so, I mean, I the way I likened it was, even before the game, it was viewed, of course, as like fait accompli that they're going to win. My fears that it would be an awkward game were eliminated by Steph going off in the first quarter. But the atmosphere is basically like the same as it was at like the Golden State victory parade last year, I thought.
It was a very strange hybrid between a couple of things, because the atmosphere also kind of felt like the finals, just in terms of the amount of media and the amount of just kind of attention and buzz. But it was so much less tension. Like the finals, even when it came back for game five, and the Warriors, you know, had that game four where they kind of solved it, there was a lot of tension in it. But there wasn't that. It was basically just this expectation. And, you know, the Warriors played tight for the first couple minutes. But for me, the part of this game, beyond everything that happened kind of towards, you know, after the game and everything, was when Curry went off. And the crowd just blew the roof off the building when they kind of, because not only were they celebrating Curry and his amazing season, but the basically what had then become a reality, which was that this team was going to win 73.
Yeah, once they went up by 10, you felt like, all right, it's fine. And it was clear also that Memphis just had no chance to defend them at all. I mean, Steph made 6 threes in the first quarter. He had 20 points. At one point, I think at halftime, he was 7 of 11 from the field. All 11 shots were threes, and he had 2 free throws. That's it. That was and it didn't count as a field goal attempt, obviously, because he got fouled. Those was his only attempt inside the arc. And then in the third quarter, he just started getting to the basket at will, getting fouled. It was just an unbelievable performance by him. Really kind of a bookend performance. And if you think about it, that New Orleans game at the start of the year, he went absolutely nuts. The first game of the year against kind of a decimated team in New Orleans at the time, just like the Grizzlies were. And he just went absolutely crazy in this game, too. He ended up with 46 points in less than 30 minutes, and it was 27 shooting possessions was all he needed to get the 46 points. Absolutely crazy. 10 out of 19 from three, the most three-pointers that we mentioned before that he had ever taken in his career. And yeah, I mean, it was just, for me, I just love being there. Warriors fans love being there. And Klay Thompson pretty much felt the same way. Here's what he said after the game.
What a magical regular season it was. I can't believe it's over. It went by incredibly fast, but it was a great feeling in that locker room. And Steve told us how proud he is of us. He told us, you know, he never thought 72 wins would be broken and for us to do it. And it's, I'm going to look back on this and think about it as the best time of my life. You know, it was unbelievable. Just every away arena we went to was sold out, plenty of Warrior fans, and not a lot of players get to experience that, so I'm really grateful for it.
Well, yeah, I thought Klay is usually not the most loquacious, but I actually took his words to heart. You know, just covering this team, this is one of the coolest things I'll probably ever be at. You know, I'm sure you feel the same way. And I was just really kind of happy to be there. I mean, what are you going to take away from this night the most, you think?
I spent a lot of time. There were stretches of time also. I think it helped not having Twitter for the first quarter of this game. I've covered the team for 7 years, and as much as winning the championship, and especially winning it as the number one seed, was kind of an amazing, like, wow, look how far this team has come moment, this was something else, because this is like, oh, it's not just, look, they made it to the mountaintop. This is like, they're going to be in the conversation for the best teams of all time. Draymond, of course, had a quote on that as well. But that was something that, what to me is a whole different level. I mean, when you listen to the podcast that you did with Kevin Pelton that was so great on the historical teams, and thinking to myself, we just saw a team that whoever fills our role 20 years from now, whether it's us or other people, we'll be talking about in that same vein. And to have been there day in, day out, and to, for me, having developed these personal relationships and just knowing these guys since they came into the league, like, it felt to me in a way more full circle than winning this title did.
And the fact that they did it at home too, you know, because the Bulls in that season, they won number 70 on the road in Milwaukee. Now, they did have a fair amount of Bulls fans there because it's only 90 miles away, but still kind of not really the same. And then they ended the season as well. Their 72nd win, I think, was on the road against Washington, you know, and kind of a Washington team that wasn't going anywhere that year. So that wasn't really like that big of a game either. And this was just kind of different. So for the fans to just kind of be going crazy throughout pretty much the entire game. I mean, as soon as we walked in the building, we kind of like hang out in the media area before the game, and usually we'll go up to our seats maybe about 5 minutes before game time is. And at that point, like when the Warriors actually ran out to do their just layup line, they got like a standing ovation from the crowd, all of whom were there like 15 minutes before the game too. Like, it was really, it was an expensive ticket, but the fans, I thought, were pretty great throughout just about the entire game.
Yeah, and one of the other aspects that made this game really special, what that I didn't expect to be relevant, was Stephen Curry's chase for 400. I mean, I thought it was one of those things. He needed 8 three-pointers to get 400 in the season. The previous record was his own at 286. And all of a sudden, you know, halfway through the first quarter, maybe 3 minutes left in the first quarter, it becomes not an if question, but a when question. And that totally dumbfounded me.
Yeah, he hit those three threes in a row. I think to take them, basically, that's what built the 10-point lead that they had. They were like tied at 18 or something like that, or it was like 18 to 16, and then he hit three threes in a row, and they're up to 27, and, you know, I don't think it ever even really got under 10 points any point after that. When he hit that third three, like, I don't recall ever hearing it that loud. You said the only time you could remember was when they clinched in Game 6 in 2013 against the Nuggets. Like, it was so loud that, like, it felt like it was just going to, like, peel the skin off of my head. Like, it was so loud. It was awesome.
Yeah.
Just fantastic atmosphere.
Yeah, so, like, for me, that Nuggets game, I lost the hearing in my right ear for a few hours, so, like, that was a little bit different. And it's funny because I was actually in almost an identical seat. I think I was two seats over for that game. But it was just really incredible. And one of the things that you and I started talking about during this game was trying to find a comparison. Well, three-pointers are far from the only thing he does well. They are the thing that he does at the volume, unlike anybody else, of trying to find a comparison for what Stephen Curry is doing there. And you can't really find it in basketball. You have to really look to other sports.
I think so. Wilt's 100-point game would have to be up there. But, like, over the course of and him averaging 50 points a game, I mean, I think the next year he averaged 44, and the year before that he'd averaged, like, 38. But it's definitely, like, three-pointers is probably a smaller part of the game. Maybe not, though. I mean, like, the three-pointer and the home run are, like, kind of similar in some ways, right? And I mean, the one that came to mind for me was Babe Ruth, who I think it had 29 homers, which it was, like, more than, like, a bunch of teams had in 1919. And then when he got traded to the Yankees or sold to the Yankees, the next year he had 54 homers that year. And that was, I think that might have been more than every other individual team had that year. So that's, like, kind of up there. I mean, Steph beating his previous record. And then some of Wayne Gretzky's seasons as well in the early 80s, where he, like, took the points and goal records out, like, way beyond what they had been before, is, like, something that people tweeted at me as well. But yeah, you know, there, suffice to say, there are not a lot of analogs to that, to what he did this year. I mean, you certainly would have thought that 400 would be completely impossible, and that's why I think he should be most improved player, because he's, like, 50% better in this category than he was last year when he was already the best. And, like, he's improved his skill level so much beyond anything that anyone ever thought was possible. You know, like, I don't think anyone would have thought that Steph being this good this year was, like, possible for any player to ever be. Whereas CJ McCollum, where he's improved, you know, hundreds of players have played at the level that he played at this year.
A quick anecdote that I don't think you know is that in January, I was working on a piece for, I think it was for Warriors World, and I was trying to find a comparison for Curry, and I had looked at the Babe Ruth home run thing, and I was kind of tooling with the numbers, and this is January, so it was a long way away, and I'm like, I don't remember the numbers because I didn't write it down because I decided not to write the piece, but it was, oh, Steph would have to make the parallel, he would have to get into the low 400s. There's no chance. And so I just dropped the piece. I never put the research into anything, so I don't know exactly what the numbers are. I'm probably going to go back and do it now. But I had that conversation and went, there's just no way he's going to get there.
Well, so our buddy Marcus Thompson asked Steph about just the historical numbers that he had this year.
Steph, you had 400 threes. You joined the 50, 45, 90 club, average 30. Some say this is the greatest season ever. What do you think about when you think back on the season you had, especially, you know, considering how your career started?
I mean, honestly, those are numbers that, you know, I've worked for and tried to elevate my game to that level. That 50-40-90 club, something I've talked about as a shooter, that's something that I found pretty special. Just over, you know, I played 79 games and be able to shoot volume and accuracy and all that kind of stuff. That's something that, you know, that's why I shoot all the reps that I do and go out and play the way that I do. So that's a pretty cool accomplishment. You know, the other stuff is just, you know, I want to be great. I want to be the best I can be. And I think I've found a way in these last couple of years to just keep getting better and keep, you know, doing, little things that you might not see, you know, in the summer and in off days that really help my confidence when I'm out there on the floor, that I can feel like I really can do anything. So that's what I'm about.
Yeah, I thought the last part of what Steph said was telling, and I've actually always kind of wanted to ask him this, and I probably will at some point, of just, you know, what it feels like to just, like, he knows that he feels like he can do anything on the court, right? Like what is it like to have that confidence, that satisfaction of just knowing that there's no one else out there who can do the things that you're doing? Like, what is that like? You know, this is not exactly like the most analytical question that you would normally get on a Dunked On podcast, but just that feeling of doing things that nobody else, like, not only statistics, but just the actual, like, physical shots, the things that he is doing with the ball, where he's shooting from, like, all of that being things that are you have never been done before. Like, what's that like? And I think you kind of got a glimpse of that, of just like, yeah, he really does feel like he can do just about anything out there. And that, like, what a powerful feeling that is, that's allowed him to push these limits, to get to the point where, you know, he puts in the work on this stuff and he has confidence in taking basically any shot that he can out there.
And with the Warriors, you have this kind of confluence of factors that you have the team having this incredible season, both from a wins perspective and from an overall dominance kind of facet, if you want to say that. Curry having not only an MVP year, but a real top shelf MVP year. And one other one, it's not, of course, as cohesive as that. Klay Thompson this year had more threes than every season in NBA history except two. And those two being Stephen Curry this year and Stephen Curry last year. And so you just kind of how that has fallen by the wayside because of the just magnificence of this overall season top to bottom.
Yeah, it is. And we'll, I'm sure, talk much more once you know, if they do win the championship, to see where they kind of rank historically. But I did take a chance to ask Andrew Bogut a little bit about that. Yeah, Bogut is always an amusing quote on some of those issues. We've of course railed against the old timers who have been dismissing this team, and you know, I obviously think that that's hogwash, and that they really deserve to be celebrated. And anything else that you kind of remember from the atmosphere or the night or the game itself?
I think it was it was such a joyous crowd. And I think something as a Barrier resident in a different, kind of in a different way than you, you've been here a while, but I was born and raised here, is that no team in recent history has won a championship in their home stadium. That isn't something that's happened. The Warriors didn't do it. None of the Giants' three World Series were that way. Of course, football teams never win in their home stadium. The A's, I believe, did in 89. But
no, they
won a candlestick?
No, they won a candlestick because, remember, it was game three.
That had the earthquake.
The earthquake,
that's right,
happened.
And so like, I thought that tonight was the closest that they've come to that. And it was this really weird catharsis because I think while everyone in this organization, everyone in the fan base wants and expects more, I think they were able to take a second to appreciate how amazing an accomplishment this is in and of itself. And yeah, there would be a hollowness to it, just like that Patriots season where they went 16-0 and didn't win the championship. But it is an achievement that will stand on its own. And of course, the team hopes that it won't have to. But I think that the fans really celebrated that for what it was.
Yeah, and Steph even took some time to reflect about that himself.
Steph, you had a lot of time during that fourth quarter to sit down on the bench and just survey the scene. What did you see, and what emotions were going through you?
It's really hard to put into words. I mean, I remember my rookie year here, and just the difference that last game of the season, just a different feel it was. I had time, and I really did, you know, take a moment. I don't think I was watching the game for about 2 minutes, just sitting thinking about how far we've come, and just the energy that was in the building was unbelievable. So I wanted to just appreciate that. You know, I had kind of snapshots of moments, you know, in Oracle Arena, notably like the playoff series against the Spurs, where I was addressing the crowd after a game six loss, thanking the fans for, you know, all their loyal support and a great journey. But we were headed home after that. So, you know, thinking about, you know, that moment and kind of the difference in you know, what tonight meant.
All right, I think that is probably a good one to end on. definitely just do that survey. That will help us out immensely. That's all we're going to plug today. Podsurvey.com/capspace. Podsurvey.com/capspace. That really will make a huge difference in our business going forward on our one-year anniversary. So that we really appreciate your listenership so much and making the show what it's been, and just the happy coincidence that there is this unbelievable night of basketball tonight. We will get to all the playoff previews tomorrow, talk about what happened in the East today. I kind of wanted this to just be its own show with these two kind of seminal moments today. So thanks so much for listening. Danny and I will be back tomorrow night. Don't forget about that survey, podsurvey.com/capspace. Talk to you all next time.